I don't think there's any idea, anyone has a real idea of how to put those things in one coherent story where the things are really sort of consistent. So, again, also to sort of put myself in a slightly different setting, I'm decided also to give my talk slightly backwards, essentially. So, start with the end of my talk and then work my way towards the beginning. So the final sort of picture that I'm going to argue in favor of is one that perhaps you could indeed have already arrived at just by thinking about this picture that Lenny also drew at the end of his introduction to the workshop, is that if you take space-time, there's a description of space-time physics that should essentially be local and have some features, of course, that lead to quantum field theory. The way we know it works for particle physics. And then there's the holographic theory. So there is some kind of screen somewhere that could be, say, our horizon, or at least it's the place where we want to have this reduced description. And this description, of course, is completely scrambled in terms of that. But for now, okay, let's assume that I can think of this holographic screen as still as a thing that actually has geometry, and indeed it has geometry because we know it has an area, and that area accounts for at least it's a way of measuring the entropy. And maybe if you take sort of a local point of view from the screen, then the screen itself has pixels, and the number of pixels on the screen is the area, and so let's indeed call them pixels. That are sitting over here, and n is that number which is proportional to the area. But in space-time, we also have pixels, or how do you call them?
Voxels.
Voxels. Okay. Voxels. So the voxels have volumes. So they're going to be, say, k voxels. Voxels, by the way, are they space points or space-time points?
Oh, I think they're space points.
Space points? Space points, yeah. Actually, I'm going to be taking them to be space-time points. Should I call them differently?
You have to invent your own name.
It's voxels. Actually, let me call them
voxels.
I missed that one.
Voxels.
In some ways, there
I think
is
there's a C and an H in there.
So in some ways, there should be some kind of formulation that connects these two completely different perspectives. Again, over here, things again should look local. Here, perhaps things should look local as well, at least in terms of those the pixels. But there's probably going to be some non-local map or something complicated that goes between here and there. By the way, k and n, I would assume, are going to be finite numbers. So for now, I'm going to take my space-time to be some Euclidean space-time m, and later on I'll take it to be S4. And therefore, it seems reasonable, at least if you want to have some way of reconciling these two perspectives, that the type of degrees of freedom that you would want to look at might be maps that are often out Q that go between the space-time and the holographic screen, and there may be maps that go the other way around, which are Q dual or Q transpose maps. And these Qs are K times N matrices. Q transpose are n times k matrices. So this will indeed be the form of a theory that I'll argue can be obtained from a perspective of gauge theory on space-time, of a local, in principle, that looks like a local theory that lives on space-time. But it seems to have already ingredients of this nature that would allow a more sort of a holographic perspective. So one way of thinking about these degrees of freedom, indeed this n, is similar as what appeared in the talk of Eric, that if you think about the degrees of freedom or the entropy of a volume of space, and you want to say, well, the holographic bound on the entropy gives you n, that you should think about n not so much as the size of a matrix, the n squared of a matrix, but it's actually the size of the column vector on which the matrix of which these matrices act. And the way in which I'm going to make a connection with things that we know about from string theory and other things is indeed to think about these Schmachsels as being instantons. And then it's sort of tempting to do the following, is that if you have your spacetime coordinates x, then morally speaking, these q's sort of can still be thought of as functions that depend on x. And then I can make an n by n matrix by thinking about these q's indeed as column vectors in n, but also as things that depend on x, and then form something like this, where this would be some n times n matrix, but it is an instanton, essentially, in space-time, where k is the instanton number. So that's the picture that will start appearing, that the way in which the holographic description, the holographic screen is going to be related to the space-time is through these kind of matrices that have knowledge about both things. Now, if for example, if space-time is indeed an S4, then we can think about it as the Euclidean version of a De Sitter space. And if this has a radius R, then you might think that this thing should have indeed this is the De Sitter horizon, as radius has area R squared. So n would be proportional then to R squared. And so a naive way of measuring the volume of our space-time would just be have Planck volumes, and then this k you would think would be proportional to n squared. It turns out that in the proposal that I'm going to be making, there's going to be one piece of additional information that I'm going to add to a space-time point, because in some ways you could indeed expect that what these maps Q are, they're going to be a map that gives you, and again, a way of representing the physics in space-time on this holographic screen, but perhaps that thing is not completely uncorrelated, and there might be some information of this holographic screen that's still contained in some kind of initial data that you put here. So the additional information that we're going to put here is sort of essentially like the momentum of this point, but essentially only the direction in which a particle would go. So suppose I put a particle here at this point, and I give it a direction, then this q will also have in it information about how the direction of that particle in the end is going to be related to how it ends up on the holographic screen. So as we will see, this n, this k will be proportional actually to n cubed, which is n squared times space-time points. But also there's an additional n, which essentially you can think of as putting on top of this point in space-time an additional image version of the holographic screen, which is essentially the sky above that point. So it contains the S2 of all possible directions in which a particle could go. So that's the picture. So how are we going to reformulate quantum field theory in this way? So that's going to be the endpoint. So let's use some hints. So we want to get a holographic perspective on our world. And of course, the place to start is with the only holographic theory that we sort of understand, which is ADS-CFT. And again, what ADS-CFT tells us is that if we have a QFT, and let's, again, put that QFT in four dimensions, and it would be n equals 4 mLs, that if I think about adding an extra dimension, which I can think of as of course, the ADS direction, and we think about it as energy scale, then by adding energy scale as an extra dimension, magically, we're having a dual description integral gravity in an ADS space. And if you would imagine being able to take a continuum limit where you take the UV scale all the way to infinity, you have really a non-compact ADS space, and then you have an equivalence with the conformal field theory in that case, if it's asymptotically ADS. However, what I'm going to be interested in is a description of this quantum field theory where, in principle, in four dimensions, I'd like to add gravity. And the question is, how would you do that from this perspective? And a very rough, at least, image of what a four-dimensional field theory plus gravity looks like is sort of like a Randall Sundin version, where you take this UV cutoff, but you don't send it off to infinity, but you replace it by some kind of brain, or you replace it by some warp compactification, where you cut off the ADS geometry at some scale, where the UV scale would then be your Planck scale. Now, you could say, well, okay, let's indeed do this in terms of a warp compactification, but I'm not going to be satisfied with that, because if I take a warp compactification and write down a string theory, I'm already going to be introducing degrees of freedom that are vastly overcounting what you would expect from the point of view of holography. So low-energy string theory, certainly effective low-energy string theory, is not going to be the thing that I'd like to do. But AESCT already gives me a bit of a hint of how I should be doing the string compactification.
Sorry, Herman, can I ask you about that point?
Yes.
Just briefly. I mean, I would have said that string theory looks like a valid theory of gravity, so any solution that it has will be consistent with the holographic bounds, I would guess. Are you saying something else? Or?
What I'm saying is that I'm interested, and again, Lenny said it very clearly, if you're interested in accounting for the degrees of freedom, which is what I'm interested in, and I want to be able to account for degrees of freedom, then the low-energy effective field theory or string theory is not the right framework. The low-energy effective field theory or string theory is the right framework of looking for vacua, of looking at long-distance questions. But if you really want to are interested in accounting of degrees of freedom, if you're interested in information, then that formulation is inadequate.
Not just the low energy description, but the full strength theory.
The full strength theory, in some ways, is even worse. Right? The full strength theory is even worse because it has many more degrees of freedom than the low energy effective field theory. So both the low energy effective field theory and the full strength theory, right from the start, have degrees of freedom that in the end somehow have to cancel out. And we don't know how it cancels out. So perhaps is there a way where those things don't appear at all? Now again, we have examples that again are somewhat more holographic than string theory by itself. ADS-CFT is one of them, and the other theory that was before ADS-CFT is matrix theory. Is there a question? Where in matrix theory, what was done is that that kind of was another version where at least we had some accounting of the degrees of freedom of what string theory is, where you start out with d particles, and you take n d particles, and you take n to infinity, and you take again an appropriate of a prime to zero limit. Essentially, ADS-CFT came about by a similar limiting procedure, but then you take these three brains. And essentially, this kind of way of representing degrees of freedom has a better chance of accounting, not overcounting what's going on. So it's sort of a holographic perspective. So the idea could be the following, is that since if I'm interested in four-dimensional quantum field theory, at low energies, the theory should indeed kind of look like a quantum field theory. But the addition of gravity somehow should amount to introducing some kind of cutoff at some scale. And if I'm not going to use a string compactification, instead what I would like to do is I'd like to give some kind of matrix description of that compactification. So essentially what you would like to do is you want to take this quantum field theory, and supposedly it's n equals 4 Yamil's theory. The question you could ask, is there a way of embedding this inside of some kind of matrix theory that gives a cutoff. Then the hope would be that cutoff version would not only have the n equals 4 emails theory, it might also have some things that are fluctuating along, or at least are propagating along the four directions, the four-dimensional space, and what you hope is that there's actually a graviton, a 4D graviton, that's being added to the story. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, okay, so where does one start? So there's one third idea that kind of got me thinking about this, and it's, I'm going to introduce it motivated from the picture that I was describing here, but there's going to be an additional motivation that I'll talk about in a second. But let me first illustrate the challenge. So the challenge that you would have to meet here is that this particular matrix description kind of has to discretize space-time, because space-time by itself cannot be completely continuous, because even just having a continuum of space-time points already overcounts the number of degrees of freedom. But can you have a covariant regulator of Q of T? And to illustrate the problem, let me briefly go back here. If you take this intuition, basically what's going on here, I can take this equation and turn it around and basically say that the way I have to think about these matrices Q is actually that they satisfy some form of a Dirac equation. This equation here essentially means that Q satisfies that Dirac equation in the background of some large instanton, of a gauge field with a large instanton number. And the number of solutions to this Dirac equation is of order k. Because indeed this is an n times n matrix, this is an n times k matrix, and each k component of this n times k matrix satisfies this equation. So this you could call lambda orbits, or if you think these are really state elements of the lowest Landau level, and what you would like indeed is that the dimension of the lowest Landau level of a gauge field is indeed this number k. And so this is sort of the intuition that you would also have if you have a theory that's non-commutative at very short distances, where the space-time points, the Schmucksels or the fuzzy points, can be thought of as states that live at the lowest Landau level of some theory with some strong gauge field turned on. However, so in general, if you have lowest Landau orbits, you're turning on a magnetic field. And having an UV cutoff.
These are lowest Landau levels in four dimensions.
Right.
So these are some special kind of Landau levels.
What do you mean by special in this case?
Zhang.
Yeah, right. That's correct. So indeed, this is where I was getting to, is that if you want to do this while preserving the fact that you want to do things covariantly, you don't want to give up, again, rotation invariance, for example. So you shouldn't be thinking about this A as being some kind of magnetic field, because a magnetic field immediately picks some special planes, special directions, whereas we want to do things covariantly. So indeed, there was a proposal that actually Lenny pointed me to a couple of months ago by Zhang and Hu, that indeed, 10 years ago, came up with a similar kind of system where they were trying to have some kind of interesting 4D realization of theories with excitations with all kinds of spin, but a version of the quantum Hall effect. But they looked at a special SO5 invariant instanton background on S4. So again, S4 is our space-time, and when I say covariant, I'm going to mean indeed, for now, in Euclidean space, SO5 invariance. And the intuition here at this point is that once you would be able to do this in Euclidean space, hopefully you would know how to build a regulator of a QFT that would represent Lorentzian, would preserve Lorentzian invariants in the Minkowski setting. So the basic statement is the following: that if you take a U n gauge theory, which is what that gauge field is over there, then indeed there's a very special instanton, type of instanton, that is the maximal SO5 symmetric instanton that one can write down. And indeed it turns out that if k is equal to half times n squared minus 1, that indeed one can, oh sorry, this is actually n as u n minus 1. That one is taken here. You take the u n minus 1 instanton. Sorry, s u n minus 1. And you give it this particular instanton number, then there are special instantons that essentially were called the Young monopole that you should think of as essentially something that sits in the middle. So there's some kind of monopole solution in some five-dimensional space that sits in the middle of an S4, so there's some flux pointing out here, but that flux is done in a SO5 invariant way. And then you can indeed look at the lowest Landau level solutions, and indeed you find that there is going to be this many lowest Landau level states. Now, it turns out that this particular instanton background has an interesting connection with twisted space. And twisted space indeed enters rather naturally in the discussion because of this particular picture. So what twisted space really is you take space-time, but you put on top of every point in space-time, so if this is space-time, M, then on top of every point, essentially you put a two-sphere, or a more mathematical way of saying it, is that twisted space, it's called projected twisted space, which is essentially CP3, and CP3 looks like a CP1 bundle. A CP1 is essentially S2 over S4, so this is our space-time. But we're going to be parameterizing our space-time, which is S4, with coordinates that have a little bit more information, namely not only the points on S4, but also a point on S2. And the point of S2 you have to think of as indicating indeed the direction in which something propagates. And indeed, the way Penrose introduced this in 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago, is by writing using, again, spinner notation to introduce things that he called pi. So let me follow his notation, pi tilde a dot. So he had two component spinners, and he wrote a momentum of a massless particle in this way. And then what he did is he essentially doubled his space by, rather than using coordinates pi a, he introduced other coordinates O a, omega a dot, in such a way that omega a dot and pi tilde b dot were canonically conjugate variables. Now, as you can see here, is that the momentum p, so this is some particle you want to specify as momentum. Instead of specifying p, you specify p and p tilde. But you have a freedom. You can rescale p by something, p tilde by something, and p by the opposite. And since rescaling p tilde up corresponds to rescaling omega down, here in this case you have a projective invariance that if you replace this by lambda times the same thing, then this is a projective symmetry. So I have four complex numbers, but I project out one complex direction. So that's how I end up with CP3. So this thing here is twisted, projective twisted space, but it's actually SCP-3. And again, what it gives you information about is both the space-time point and a direction. Now, let me explain how you get the space-time point in a second. Before I do that, let me just point out the following, is that typically in discussions of twister space, one indeed just sticks to one copy of CP3 in this particular way, but if you, of course, make an arbitrary choice, the A dot component is the right-handed, the A is the left-handed component, and here we chose to introduce a dual variable for the right-handed component. Of course, I could do the same thing and also introduce an omega A, which is purported, which is dual to P pi B, which is delta A B, which means that there's a dual twister space, which you can call pi tilde A and omega tilde. Sorry, how did this work? Pi A dot omega tilde A. Actually, we'll typically write it like this. Omega tilde A, pi A dot. I think it's like that. So I'm going to use this, call these things Z alpha. Alpha run from 1 to 4. And I'll call these things Z tilde alpha, where these run from also from 1 to 4. Let me call them Z tilde alpha, an upper index. So this thing is the dual twister space to this twister space. So this is twister space. But the two things are dual to each other in the exact same way as that P and X are dual to each other. And what you can show is that the commutation relations between P and X the usual commutation relations imply that Z alpha and Z beta satisfy these canonical commutation relations. So this is just ordinary quantum mechanics, and essentially we've done nothing new at this point. However, we have reformulated the ordinary commutation relations of between momentum and position into commutation relations between two variables that I call Z and Z tilde. Now, what's going to be the surprising thing here, and that's the following, is that in Euclidean space, it turns out that Z tilde alpha is naturally viewed as the complex, the Hermitian conjugate of Z alpha. And vice versa, of course. So if I do this twice, I get the same thing back. So what's surprising about it is that this turns out into a creation annihilation type commutation relation. In addition, we have the following fact that the rescalings of Z alpha, which is a symmetry that I have to divide out, and this means that this thing goes to the inverse. So this is a symmetry that you have to divide out, and therefore there's a conserved charge Q associated with that symmetry. Or let me call it D, which is Z tilde alpha Z alpha. And that conserved charge has to commute with all the observables that I have, because this should be a symmetry, and therefore this thing should commute with all my observables. And if I now start using this parameterization for my space-time physics, what I have to impose in the end is also a constraint, which is sort of like a Gauss law constraint that imposes this particular symmetry on my states. And what you can do is you can essentially impose that this thing on some state, which is in the Hilbert space of the Z's and the Z tildes, and I can require that this is equal to some constant times the state. But that constant has to be an integer, And indeed, there's a choice of integer that you have to pick in order to divide out this particular symmetry.
Sorry, these states are functions of z? What is the vector mean? It means a function of z?
So for me, for now, at least the way indeed I'm going to be building my states, but those states you have to kind of think of indeed as being these space-time points, your smoxels. Smoxels are going to be the states. So the smoxels are annihilated by d up to, again, they're giving me n times that state. And indeed you can now count how many of these states there are, because I have four harmonic oscillators, they're four coordinates. This is here is the number operator. It's the oscillation number of my harmonic oscillator, and I have four harmonic oscillators that whose oscillation level has to add up to big N. And if you count the number of such states, it's equal to K, the number K that I had over here, where that big N is related to the little n here, like this. So little n is big N. So this is actually SUN. So if you make that particular relation. So this was indeed noted in the literature back when Zhang and Hu made their proposal, is that their lowest Landau level states can actually be described in this particular way. Now, what's surprising again about this, I find, at least, and it's something that hasn't appeared in the literature much before, except indeed in the Zhang Hu papers, is that this indeed gives you a regulator for space-time points that's essentially Lorentz invariant. So what happens here is that these commutations actions definitely don't violate any symmetries because they're completely equivalent to this. And this particular requirement also does not break any of the space-time symmetries, so at least not any of the...
But we're still in Euclidean space.
I'm in Euclidean space, and I've kept the SO5 symmetry. I don't... So in principle, Twister space also has conformal symmetry. It's very useful for conformal symmetry. The conformal generators, once you take this reality requirements, the rescalings, and the conformal boost, etc., are non-Hermitian operators. So the SO5 invariance is preserved, but all the other conformal symmetries are no longer preserved in this setting. But So the fact that this is covariant to me was a sort of a striking fact. I hadn't really appreciated this because all the previous studies of non-commutative field theory had Lorentz violating non-symmetry.
I'm just curious. So, is this the we're on the sphere? Is this just the total angular momentum?
And in some ways, it's a total helicity. So this thing is Penrose calls this thing. I think he calls it the homogeneity operator. But in terms of a field, if a field has a non-zero commutator with d, it has non-zero helicity. So basically, what you're doing here is
so now picture. I mean, was the generalization of Landau levels to a 4+1 dimensional theory where the states are the states of fermions in the background of this F by Zhang?
Right. So in the Zhang Hu case, they would indeed have their SO4 as being their space.
That's what you meant by state over there.
So when I say lowest Landau level here, kind of. So that's the idea, is that your space-time points become lower Landau level states of a one dimension of a theory that lives in one more dimension. That's
right. At a time dimension.
That's correct. So up to now, at least the characterization of the space-time physics perhaps looks the same as what Zhang and Hu did, but I'm going to be doing something different, which is partly motivated by this idea, but also motivated by the fact that twisters have sort of since Zhang and Hu have had a different revival, where I want to find another piece of chalk that's bigger than this one. Where twister methods actually have been used very successfully to study N equals Fourier Mills theory, and there's sort of a reformulation of twister theory, of N equals Fourier Mills theory in terms of twister variables. So basically, what's now what one can do is, rather than using ordinary space-time coordinates, one can start doing field theory on this twister space, and then use this idea of getting some kind of regulated version of n equals 4 Young-Mills. And the fact that things are still covariant is at least gives you some hope that some of this mechanism that I was aiming for here might still be present. So, of course, the twister technique for studying NX4 Young-Mills theory has, again, but now been very well developed with the BCFW recursion relations and et cetera. But it started out with Witten's observation that if you take twister space, but you actually really do the appropriate twister space for n equals 4 Young-Mills theory. So I'm adding in supersymmetry for convenience, and also maybe because of arguments that perhaps one needs supersymmetry initially for something that works holographically. But this thing actually is a Calabi-Yau space. And one can write down a very natural theory in general on a Calabi-Yau space, which is known as the holomorphic Chern-Simons theory, which is you take your CP3/4, you have a natural 3,0 form on your Calabi-Yau space, and you take some gauge field on your twister space. So A now is a field that lives on the twister space. So A is a function of coordinates z and z bar. For now, just to be clear, this is going to be a commutative twister space. So I'm not going to do this non-commutative twister space. It's in a commutative twister space. And then this could be a starting point for relating it to n equals 4 Young-Mills theory. But the n equals 4 Young-Mills theory that you initially get is only a subset of the really n equals 4 Young-Mills theory. You basically get n equals 4 Young-Mills theory at zero coupling, or a more accurate way of saying it is that the equations of motion of this particular theory essentially tell you that f, the 2,0 form of f, which is sort of del bar a plus a commutator a, is equal to zero. And it's a very old result of Ward that and Artea, that if you take things that satisfy this particular equation on twister space, that it's equivalent to looking at instantons in n equals 4 Young-Mills theory, at least in this particular case, in the supersymmetric case. So essentially what this theory is, it's the equations of motion of this particular theory force you to have a self-dual field strength in four dimensions. So suppose that this would be our UV theory for now. And suppose that this is some UN gauge theory on twister space. The proposal that I should mention here that I've done with Jonathan Ekman, and it's in a short paper, and we'll be writing a longer paper, is that in order to obtain an interesting sort of decoupling limit of this theory that has interesting dynamics, is you could take this theory, which by itself looks completely boring because it only looks at instantons on in four space. And
ordinary instantons with a C2 group?
Any instanton. It could be SUN instantons. So
no,
if this is an SUN theory.
Simple instantons in SUN theory?
Any instanton. So it could be things with instanton number k. So it can have a very large instanton number. And so the second Chern class or whatever, the instanton number on the twister space of this particular gauge field configuration projects down to a gauge field on S4. So this is part of what's called the twister correspondence. What you do is your twister space has these extra spheres in it. And essentially what you do is you project down from this M times S2, which is essentially your twister space, you project down onto S4, and then you get a self-dual gauge field in four dimensions.
Herman, is this related to the matrix model that that the Japanese group?
Yeah, I was talking to Mark von Ransom, and he...
Is it the same thing, or closely related?
It could be closely related. I should look at that thing again. So that, that indeed you can take a very, you can take a matrix model and take the large energy. But I should say at this point, I haven't sort of done the matrix model part of it yet. I started out with something that in principle is continuum theory, but I'm looking at a very large instanton sector in that continuum theory. And basically the idea is to start looking at the instanton moduli space. It's essentially the Higgs branch that Eric was talking about this morning, which is the complete instanton moduli space in this K instanton sector. And the claim is indeed the following, is that, that if I take this SUN gauge theory onto the space, and I go to the K instanton sector, where K again is given by that number, and I look at the homogeneous instanton, the one that's symmetric, SO5 symmetric on S4, that you can characterize that gauge field essentially as the Berry phase of the solution to these equations. So let me make that slightly more explicit by talking about one other important ingredient in the whole story. I'm tall enough. Look. So, a special role, of course, in twister techniques is played by what's known as the twister lines. So I didn't tell you too much about this yet. Is that I've given you the information that there was these coordinates z alpha, which I denoted as pi a and omega a dot. And I told you that, again, it essentially lives on this space like here, but there's a space-time point x here. So how do you obtain the space-time point x? And the claim is that the following is true, that if I take a space-time point x, I can characterize it by indices a dot again. And if I, sorry, upper indices, a dot a, that if I take a dot a times pi a, the vector of I, and that's equal to omega a dot. So this is a set of, two sets of equations, and if you solve these equations, this is a CP1 within CP3, and the claim is that if I choose my point x here, that those equations tell me exactly what the corresponding S2 is within twister space. So again, this is known as a twister line. And lines in twister space correspond to space-time points. By the way, again, twisters work the other way around as well. If I point, take a point in twister space, I get essentially a light ray in space-time. So that's the funny translation that's going on. And now, okay, let me talk a little bit of history here, which it took me a little while to reconstruct. Twisters have played a pivotal role, indeed, in what's known as the ADHM description of instantons. So instantons have a whole moduli space. And indeed, the moduli space of instantons can, on the one hand, be characterized in this way. That's what's called as the Ward correspondence. But then later, ADHM, Thea Greenfield, Hitchin, and Manin, came up with a more abstract, sort of more convenient way of characterizing things in terms of matrices. And what ADHM did can be the best way of explaining it, indeed, in terms of a matrix or deep brain type description, is that you take n d4 brains, or take n d4 brains, and you take, it could be Euclidean d3 brains, but it's Euclidean d4 brains, and I take k d0 brains, and again, I play the game that, again, a lot of us have played.
Wait, the zero brains or instant brains?
Yeah, as I said, if I do d4, I should do shoot d0. If you want me to make this d3, this becomes d minus 1. So these are instantons, and if you start dissolving these things inside of the d4 brain, then indeed you would be writing down precisely strings that stretch between the K d0 brains and the N d4 brains, and I can call those Q and Q transpose. Again, which are n times k matrices, or q is a k times n matrix. And what they are, indeed, is they are the open strings that go between the d0 brains and the d4 brains. And the equation of motion, or at least the ADHM equation, works as follows, is that there are also, and let me see if I can straighten this out correctly, there are also other matrices that correspond to strings that go between the D0 brains. I'll call them X, which are K by K matrices. And essentially, there's an equation, something of the form that XI commutator with XJ. Let me be a bit schematic here. There's some kind of equation of this sort that if I take the commutator between those things, that's equal to Q T cube, or maybe it's the other way around, Q transpose. This is known as the ADHM equation, and essentially it's the equation of the D-term constraint of the corresponding gauge theory that you would be constructing here. And but the key point is that you can parameterize the space, the moduli space of those instantons as the Higgs branch of this particular brain configuration. And this is indeed the point where you have a matrix description. I started out with a theory that essentially is just a continuum transimage theory, but I go to a k-instanton sector, and the k-instanton sector has a moduli space, and that moduli space is being parameterized by these matrices. So, so now I have a matrix model, which I could call the ADHM matrix model, that parameterizes whose equations of motion correspond to these ADHM equations. And the claim is the following, is that this ADHM matrix model indeed parameterizes a theory that looks quite closely to the theory that Witten was considering to describe N equals 4 AMLs theory. So what Witten did was the following. He had this particular starting point, but in order to really describe N equals 4 AMLs theory, this theory was not enough because he only had the instantons. So what Witten did is he added an additional degree of freedom to this story, where he had these strings. Essentially, in this theory, he viewed this theory as an open string theory, and it's indeed equivalent to an open string theory. And he was adding the D strings that essentially wrap these trisomites. So if once you add the D-strings on that wrap the trisomites, indeed he would have additional degrees of freedom in this theory, which would be the strings. Okay, so let me back up for a second. So here I was talking about the 4D0 brain story, but that's actually a twister lift of this whole story, where I'm adding two extra dimensions, this S2, to it. So what I could have done, I could have started again with a bigger space, which is CP3, which indeed has these CP1s sitting inside of it, so I could lift this whole thing up. So I can view the CP3 as S4 with CP1s sitting on top of it. And then if I lift this whole story to here, then this D4 brain turns sort of into a D6 brain. The D6 brain wraps the S4 and the CP1, so it wraps complete CP3. And the D0 brains turn into D2 brains that wrap the CP1. And then these strings here, the QT and the Q variable, are strings that go between the D6 and the the two brains. Now, Witten indeed precisely used these variables to reproduce not only the self-dual sector of n plus 4 EMLs theory. So the self-dual sector indeed only give you the self-dual connections of the n plus 4 EMLs theory. But if you really want to get amplitudes that are not just associated with self-dual connections, you need some other degrees of freedom. And it turned out that these degrees of freedom that you associate with these strings, I call these D-strings, but they're D2-brains, at least in this way of parameterizing dimensions, were sufficient to parameterize the MHB amplitudes of n equals 4 EMLs theory, essentially as follows, that in n equals 4 EMLs theory, you could take a bunch of currents where J of Z is Q T tau A Q, where this is in some S U N and C color matrix. And you can make these currents and put a bunch of them on this two-dimensional twister line. So these Qs can be viewed as things that live on the twister line, and therefore you can take a bunch of their currents, and it turns out that, and this goes back to Nair, that the MHB amplitudes of n plus 4 EMLs theory can be written in this way. So in some ways what we've done is nothing else than what Witten was doing at the time, namely, rather than adding these strings, we're just adding these instantons, but of course we get the same degrees of freedom. And you have to interpret them indeed as strings that stretch between the D2 brain and the D6 brain, which is also how Witten thought of it. However, in our case, these Qs are not really continuum fields because they are these K10N matrices. So we don't have exactly Witten's context, we have a sort of a regulated version of it. And that's sort of where things get interesting, because in Witten's story, there was sort of a disaster that took place after he had made this match. Namely, he found that the theory not only contained gauge theory, but that it also contained gravity.
What kind of gravity?
Okay, let's talk about this right now.
You could finish up.
I'm finishing up right now. Okay. So, in Witten's story, what he did, he indeed looked at sort of double 1 over n corrections to this, 1 over nc corrections to this theory, and he found that there are other amplitudes that one can represent in this way, and those amplitudes for him looked like conformal gravity amplitudes. In our case, we actually have a somewhat different setup. What he had, he really had to look at a theory that lives on a given precise location along the S4, whereas in our case, we really have a cutoff. If you think about it, the twister line, I think I erased it, equation that and this has may have been at a different place before, but we still have, we have the analog of the twister lines in our case as well. And what happens is the following, is that we can have our Q matrices, the number of solutions to this equation is n. And what these matrices Q really are, they're maps from the full CP3 to a given CP1, but fuzzy maps because they are disk, they're matrices.
That would always be true if you just have n of one and k of the other kind of brains, but I miss. Why is that a novel feature of what you're saying at the same time?
What Witten had, he had sort of only has a D brain here, but the thing is that this N here are the space-time points on my D2 brain. So my D2 brain, for example, only has a finite set of fuzzy points.
Oh, that's it, okay.
And also my D6 brain has a finite set of fuzzy points. So
N is not the number of D2s, it's...
It is the number, it's also, yeah, so it does two things, it's... Okay,
so... That was confusing me.
The thing is that these are really matrices. So once you do the ADSM construction, you just have matrices. You no longer have fields. So that's the thing that that's the non-trivial thing that happened here, is that in the ADSM construction, these things are matrices. They're no longer fields. Whereas over there, I was still talking about things that would be fields, but they're special solutions.
Okay.
But in the end, everything is captured in terms of matrices. So the disaster that happened when Witten was doing his thing, he wanted to get continuum n equals 4 UML theory, but I'm interested in getting an n equals 4 UML theory which has a cutoff, and our theory has a cutoff. And therefore, getting gravitational amplitudes is precisely what I want. Now, you can ask, what kind of gravity do you get? So, let me just, rather since I'm in minus 2 minutes, just give the summary of where we stand right now. Is that we have identified another set of currents, which I could write down in a second, which I call, say, T of Z, which essentially look as follows, QT, and then you have to take derivatives with respect to some of the twisters, DJ, sorry, Q, DJ, I did something like this. So instead of just taking an SUN color index, what you do is you put vector fields here. And what those vector fields are, they are things that if I take a particular twister line, that deform the twister line in the transverse direction. And we have access to these kind of currents because these fields Q really span the full twister space. And actually, the non-commutativity of the gauge theory, of the theory that I have, the non-commutative commutation relations, precisely make these kind of currents very natural.
What does the D act on that?
This thing acts on? It's actually, it differentiates with respect to omega.
So it acts on the state?
It acts on the next operator.
On the next.
So similar as in this correlation functions, you have these taus that you can peel off that give you the color factors. The color factors is that in this case, this thing will act on the next operator. So I can take a bunch of these guys.
What does it mean that it's acting on a matrix?
Sorry?
What does it mean that you're acting DI on these matrices Q?
So that's the matrix language is precisely explained here. It's essentially that if I have a k column vector, I can think about it as an element of the Hilbert space, of this fuzzy Hilbert space, and these derivatives are what DJ really is. It's omega dagger A. That's what I. Sorry, maybe my notation at this point became less precise. But it's an oscillator, and it differentiates. With respect to twisters, twister coordinates.
So it is A, B in this section.
Yeah, should have been A, B, sorry. Thanks. Yeah, sorry. That's maybe a better right. So you get additional currents in the story, and you can look at the amplitudes, and it turns out that the amplitudes that you get here, so this comes back to Steve's question, are really the MHB amplitudes. I would now say there would be the MHV amplitude of gravity, but let me immediately give a Einstein gravity. But let me immediately qualify that. Is that for the MHV amplitudes of Einstein gravity, the way you can obtain them, and a recent paper by Juan actually explains why getting amplitudes in Einstein gravity is not yet a deciding factor, because the tension is really that what Witten found,
right.
He found conformal supergravity. Mm-hmm. However, conformal supergravity has solutions to the equations of motion that are also solutions to the equations of motion of Einstein gravity. And so we're able to represent the amplitudes of Einstein gravity as expectation values in our matrix model. But if you ask me, does that tell me whether the theory is really Einstein gravity or conformal gravity, I wouldn't at this point immediately be able to tell you, because the amplitudes of Einstein gravity are contained as a special subset of the amplitudes within conformal gravity because of the fact that the solutions of conformal gravity are also solutions.
So
is
it
to
the
Einstein
where the Planck scale goes,
yeah.
When you go from one scale? So you have a cutoff, so it's the Planck scale
that's right.
Induced from the cutoff?
That's right. So the fact is that step number one would be to get gravity. Because getting Einstein gravity actually to some extent is easy in the following sense. Is that an idea that goes back to Sakharov 40 years ago, is induced gravity.
Yeah.
Is you integrate that stuff and you induce an action on your space of metrics. And the thing that you induce contains the Einstein theorem. But induced gravity is not the same as really getting gravity, because you have to first know that you have to integrate over the metrics, or that the things are really propagating. So step number one is to actually show that there's a propagating spin 2 degree of freedom in the story. And so that's the step where we are right now. We have a propagating spin 2 degree of freedom, which we represent by means of bilinears of these variables Q. And you can look at the amplitudes and you can compare them with the gravity amplitudes. What does it mean? Does it mean that you get Einstein gravity? Actually, the real hard question then becomes, okay, well, what really sets the scale of the Planck constant in that case? Now, it turns out that these type of amplitudes don't really depend on the Planck constant in the sense that you can completely scale the Planck constant into the external states. So the MHB amplitude, you can scale out Planck's constants, and it depends on the normalization of the external state. So this thing just goes with m Planck to the power n minus 2, where n is the number of external particles. And so in order to know what Newton's constant is, you would have to go beyond MHB. You have to do n MHB, and you would have to understand better what's going on with all this. The real hope, of course, is that in the end there's also sort of a picture of holography coming out, but that's sort of why I gave this thing in the beginning, is that I kind of think that this description looks rather holographic, because it kind of includes these maps from space-time to something that I could call my holographic screen, which is essentially what this crystal line is, as everything is being mapped onto that screen.
In the interest of time, if there are urgent questions, then please, but otherwise, let's move on and discuss them. Okay, thanks again. Okay, so next we have Jean-Anne. And just a quick announcement before we get going. So after the